Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Everything Connects, How to Transform and Lead in the Age of Creativity, Innovation, and Sustainability by Faisal Hawk with Drake Bayer. Narrated by Kevin T. Collins. I have become my own version of an optimist. If I can't make it through one door, I'll go through another door, or I'll make a door. Something terrific will come, no matter how dark the present. Rabindranath Tagore. Foreword. Innovation is a Human Endeavor by Marshall Goldsmith. As the world has become more globally connected, our personal interconnections have grown exponentially. The speed and pace of our days has greatly increased. In this busier, more connected world, it can be difficult to take the time needed to reflect on our careers and our lives. While our opportunities and challenges seem to be growing, the time available to reflect on these opportunities and challenges seems to be shrinking. My professional mission is to help successful leaders achieve positive, lasting change in behavior. Over the years, I have seen how the leadership behaviors that have led to one level of success might not be the same behaviors needed to achieve a higher level of success. In my coaching, all my clients receive confidential 360-degree feedback. This feedback comes from managers, peers, colleagues, and direct reports. In many cases, my clients also receive feedback from family members and friends. This type of comprehensive feedback may enable us to see the blind spots that inhibit our growth. When leaders have a complete perspective, they can move forward with clarity. Buddha noted that right understanding leads to right action. One word for such a comprehensive view of life is holistic. In problem analysis, the holistic approach takes into account the whole system of causes and effects that have an impact on the problem. If the problem were a knot, the holistic problem solver would review each thread's direction and how they all fit together, how the many parts created the puzzling whole. After seeing how the tangling happened, it can be easy to untie the knot. The solution practically suggests itself. Holistic problem solving helps us systematically review the messy knots in our lives and then create clear, ready-to-implement solutions. This book helps us find holistic solutions to problems in our organizations and in our lives. To do this, it combines different disciplines. While there are many books about understanding business and many books about understanding ourselves, there are few books that address both issues at once. In addressing both of these issues, Faisal Hawk and Drake Bayer have drawn upon knowledge from many sources, including organizational theory, neuroscience, and management theory, as well as psychology, spirituality, and self-improvement. Their holistic approach illustrates how these different views of the world can be connected. The holistic approach described in the book was shaped by the backgrounds of the authors. Faisal, the entrepreneur, innovator, and elder of the duo, was born in Bangladesh, near the birthplace of Buddha, and found himself in the boardrooms of Fortune 100 companies by the time he was 27. Drake, the journalist, traveler, and younger of the two, was born in Illinois and found himself in Himalayan meditation retreats by the time he was 24. There's something disparate, united, and exciting about that combo, and their creative tension is found throughout the argument and adventure of the text. Together, they've created a book that's as much about business as it is about life, or as much about life as it is about business. In today's rapidly changing world, leaders are constantly challenged with questions such as these. How can we keep improving? What can we do that is new and better? How can we innovate? Innovation does not happen on a spreadsheet, slideshow, or product line. Innovation occurs in the interaction between people. Innovation is a human process. Faisal and Drake believe that the more we can humanize the way we work, the more innovative we become. I agree with their view that the more we understand the mental and emotional causes of innovation and creativity, the more we can untie the knots that stop our progress. The human process of innovation is not just something that happens between people. It also happens inside people. Part of innovation is self-discovery. Over my years of coaching, I have learned that we cannot have an effective conversation with others if we do not have an effective conversation inside ourselves. By learning how we can better frame conversations within ourselves, we can have more grounded conversations with our teams and our world. To me, the discussion of work-life balance often misses the point. The very phrasing implies that work and life are somehow disconnected. I don't feel this way about my work and my life, and neither do most of the mega-successful people I coach. Faisal and Drake have done a wonderful job of showing that the change we want to see in the world needs to be consistent with the change we see in ourselves. Progress is something we are all trying to achieve. As we learn in this book, progress feeds our engagement, which leads to our best work. What's exciting is that progress isn't something that only exists out there as some feathery ideal, but is something we can arrange in our days, starting today. If we understand all the threads that are knotted together in this thing called a job, this thing called a company, this thing called a nonprofit, then with a little luck, a little reorientation, we can make that progress an integrated part of this thing called life. Maybe that's why there's a bicycle chain on the cover. If you love cycling, you know that it's challenging, it's self-powered, and it's sustainable, in the sense that it's good for the environment, and in the sense that you can do it every day joyfully. Through that sustained, sustainable effort, you get better at the cycling itself. It can get you here, and it can get you there, literally. That's the same kind of journey that listeners of this book are going to go on, a journey in learning how to move our work in a self-powered, sustainable, and maybe even joyful direction. And by cycling around the whole big, beautiful mess of this unpredictable, innovation-hungry world of ours, we can start to untie the knots, both inside and outside ourselves. Marshall Goldsmith is a New York Times best-selling author and the number one leadership thinker in the world, according to the Thinkers 50 conference sponsored by Harvard Business Review. Prologue. If you were to poke around the shops of Moscow, St. Petersburg, or a Russian neighborhood in your nearest city, you may find a gorgeously carved little metaphor waiting for you on a shelf. The Matryoshka doll, what might more commonly be called a nesting doll. These dolls nest in this sense. On first taking it in, you'll find a peasant girl or woman in traditional garb, typically wearing a long, flowing dress called a sarafan. But that charming figure is more than meets the eye. Should you meet her with your hands, you'll find that she opens up and another doll is inside. And then that doll opens up into another doll, and that one into another, on and on, until you reach the smallest doll, carved from a single piece of wood, usually a baby. What appeared to be one figure was in fact many, layered inside one another like an onion, with each outer layer containing a smaller doll, and each smaller doll supporting the outer layer. What appeared to be one was actually several, but also, in a way, one. Organizations are matryoshka dolls. What appears to be one solid thing is actually several. One appearance is brought about by many. In the case of for-profit business, the outermost layer, that charming peasant girl, is the long-term health of the organization. Then, the revenue over time. But there is another layer. The way that society, the customers, users, and other humans interact with the organization and perhaps buy its products. But there's another layer within that, the product. And another layer again, the team that built the product, and another layer within that, the culture that brought together the team, and another layer within that, the psychology, the inner life of the founders or leaders of the organization. Their mental lives inform the culture, which informs the hires, which informs the product, which informs people's interactions with the company, which shapes the brand, which brings in revenue, which allows the company to thrive or not. Somewhere along that causality is a movement from the quantitative to the qualitative. The profits the company makes are, of course, tangible. They show up in a spreadsheet. But the causes that created those profits are not. There are no analytics, at least that we know of, that totally capture the inner lives of the people who made the profits. That subtle, private life is not something that translates into spreadsheets very well, but it does predict bottom lines, as we'll discover in just a moment. Why is this the case? Because, we think, it has something to do with the era that we are currently in. Disruption is a word that is popular in the business world. It's used to describe the action of one company being able to provide a value, say, a product or service, much cheaper or at a much greater level of quality than the company currently in that space, which is usually called an incumbent. Often that is thought to be the result of a jump in technology. For example, the Internet, which catalyzed the rise of Netflix and the fall of Blockbuster in the United States. Though we'll later explore how it's really the fault of the organization's fixed, unadaptive structure. To put it dramatically, this evidences a shift in the priorities of the world. We previously lived in an era in which optimization and its implied rigidity was the only game in town, but we now live in a time of creativity, innovation, and sustainability, for these are the skills organizations need to be continually adaptive. The question hidden within that need for continued adaptability, in the same way the matryoshka baby is hidden within the peasant girl, is what kind of psychological practices predict creativity, which social behaviors predict innovation, and which organizational structures lead to the sustainability of all these things. The mission of this book is to find out. Introduction. Renaming roles. An entrepreneur is a person who takes responsibility for his or her economic well-being. A leader is a person who takes responsibility for the impact he or she makes on the world. However, that impact, whatever it may be, is in fact made up of myriad causes and conditions. The wise leader, then, is forever a student of the causality that makes up her endeavor. It's about knowing all those layers of the matryoshka doll. If you're trying to create an app that will change people's lives, what are the elements of that change? And which people? And how will you test that? And who could build such a thing? And what mental state would that person have to build at his best ability? The questions will keep unspooling. The matryoshka seems like it's infinite. Maybe it is. The role of the leader, as we'll discuss at length throughout this book, is to provide alignment. Why? because alignment allows people to make decisions and act faster, which propels the velocity of an organization, allowing it to get feedback and grow more quickly. But what is alignment, and where does it come from? It's about context. Why were ancient mariners able to sail without modern equipment? They, of course, were able to read the stars, without all our modern light pollution. What the stars gave them was context, a signal from which to plan and act. And a clear night, of course, would provide greater resolution for the stars, making the signal stronger and the decision more clear. The leader is also searching for richer and richer constellations, examining the intersections of the enterprise in question. As we will emphasize throughout this book, this is not merely a matter of analysis, but also of understanding. If we are trying to get humans to do something together, we need to understand our and their humanity. Such is the nature of holistic business. The journey to come. To borrow a line from Phil Libin, the highly quotable CEO of Evernote, we find that humanizing our working lives is a sufficiently epic quest to dedicate our lives to. As we'll discuss in a minute, that humanization will yield more positive experiences of work, more creativity and innovation within our organizations, greater interpersonal bonds between the people we work with, and, as the research plays out, the best shot we can give ourselves at creating value for the long term, resulting in initial public offerings for startups and diversified financial rewards for mature companies. Over three sections, we will show how being pro-social, that is, oriented toward others rather than yourself, is one of the most pro-business things you can do, how being holistic and humanistic is key to doing great work. As these things tend to arrange themselves, this endless and endlessly rewarding journey will take place over three acts. In the first, we will address our own mental experiences, our social interactions, and the mindset we can take to orient ourselves to this holistic, long-term view. Then, in the middle section, we will explore the structures that lead to long-term innovation, the way to act in a manner that promotes mutual flourishing, and how, crucially, a leader can urge us along this process. In the third section, we'll see how to arrange our lives and our organizations in a way that leads to long-term value creation, surveying the subtle and not-so-subtle arts of idea generation, decision-making, and creating continuous value. We recognize that this might be a lot of new vocabulary, but don't take our word for it. The things we're about to describe will be familiar to you, though recontextualized. We've made a concerted effort to show how our individual, interpersonal, and organizational working lives all interconnect. By examining these connections, we'll learn new ways to create, innovate, adapt, and lead. That said, we invite you onto this path of meeting work again. Part 1. When, who, and how are you? Although efficiency is not the opposite of innovation, the structures and behaviors that create them may be opposed. If you want people to crank out as many widgets as possible in the shortest time, you can probably disregard their well-being until they die of exhaustion in favor of getting more and more done. However, if you are trying to bring something new into the world, you need a whole different set of behaviors. By its nature, creativity is an internal process within people, and so we must take into account the processes that happen inside them if we want to allow a group of people to be sustainably, reliably creative. The first third of our journey is dedicated to that holistic understanding. In Chapter 1, we will lay out the foundation of our argument, examining what exactly the innovation economy we find ourselves in is and the stars by which companies may navigate it. In Chapter 2, we will survey the mindsets and skill sets that stabilize people in their encounters with the volatility of entrepreneurial life, centering on the twin virtues of authenticity and mindfulness. In Chapter 3, we will hear about what it's like to work with people. Since our current problems demand more than one mind, we'll lay out what it means for people to work effectively together. Finally, in Chapter 4, we will deconstruct the long-term view. We will consider the nature of value and how a company can produce it continually. This requires a coherent sense of the organizational self, an abiding pragmatism, and a recognition of the interdependencies inherent in any individual business venture. These are all topics into which we will delve. Without further ado, let's get to the delving. Chapter 1. Understanding when, what, and who we are. You cannot step into the same stream twice. Heraclitus. A clay cup sits in front of you. How does its function change when it is full versus when it is empty? A full cup is useful in that you can drink from it, you can use the resources inside it. But what use does an empty cup have? You cannot drink from it, so how can it be useful? Which would the optimist or the pessimist choose? Is it better to be half empty or half full? Conversely, what if you wish to add more liquid to the vessel? Would you want it to be empty or full? What is the function of the liquid then? Its value? Take these questions in for a moment. Chew them. Taste them. Savor them. Done? Good. What is that cup? The vessel, according to the old Zen metaphor we're summoning, is your mind. It can be full or empty. Each state has its own implications. Which mind do you want? Which mind do you want your team to have? If you want to be thought an expert, which, if you're listening to this book, part of you does, you may privilege the full mind. After all, it's impressive to know many things, to be a font of knowledge. However, expertise implies a kind of rigidity. If your cup is full, it cannot accept more water. As a society of professionals, we've received educations previously reserved for royalty, made travels once only known to explorers, and developed skills in ourselves that are indistinguishable from magic. However, all these concepts we've accumulated are more map than territory. If we fixate our conception of the world on the systems that we build to represent it, we can lose sight of the world. Instead of seeing the world, we see only our ideas about the world. Since we've established that we have all the insight, we don't allow more to come in. This is why we need to maintain what Buddhists refer to as beginner's mind, a certain playful absence of assumptions. As Shunryu Suzuki writes, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, but in the expert's there are few. And since innovation is the result of successive ventures into possibility, as we'll get into later, we're motivated to immerse ourselves in possibility to, as Emily Dickinson wrote, dwell in possibility, for it is a fairer house than prose. Beginner's mind, then, is a practice of approaching our experiences empty of assumptions. This is one of the keys and products of mindfulness meditation, which we'll discuss further in Chapter 2. Essentially, beginner's mind is an empty vessel waiting to be filled by the raw data of doing commerce and living life. In this way, we become more vulnerable to insight. Since we don't claim to have come to the final answer, we can more readily welcome new ones. To paraphrase Adam Pisoni, Yammer's chief of technology, whom we'll get to know in part two of this book, we have to assume that everything we think is right today will be wrong tomorrow. What this demands is a nuanced understanding of the timeless and the timely. Some parts of life are timeless, such as the nature of consciousness and the nature of relationships. This is why ancient wisdom about these fundamentals remains so deeply resonant, whereas other, more emergent aspects of life, such as technology, are intensely timely. For example, the phone you carry in your pocket today is markedly different from the one you carried 5 years ago, and we can assume it is different from the one you will have 5 years from now. We can still look to Socrates for insight into teaching as the transference of knowledge, and yet we wouldn't consult him for insight into how satellite imaging transfers knowledge. Thus, we have our feet in two streams, the timeless and the timely. As entrepreneurs, that is, people who take full responsibility for our economic and psychological well-being, we need to develop an appreciation of the differences between the two. It sounds a little old-fashioned to wring our hands at the fact that everything is changing so damn fast. Instead, let's adapt to volatility. To do this, we can appreciate the space within our empty cup, appreciate how little we can fully know about the present world, and how much less we can know about what will come in 5 years. There's a word for not knowing: ignorant. Although this word usually has a negative connotation, if someone called your authors ignorant, we'd leap to defend our fragile intellectual egos. We hold that it can be positive. We can be skillfully ignorant by acknowledging that this is a complex, maybe even opaque world in which we're working. We can even get good at being ignorant. As individuals, we can build a skill set in skill acquisition, since we'll need to be learning new skills as paradigms change. At an interpersonal and organizational level, we can surround ourselves with people who shine light onto our various blind spots and treat them in a way that encourages expansive, adaptive behavior. Such practices and strategies will be explored throughout this walk of a book we have before us. On Not Standing Still. Somewhere along the way, people became convinced that stasis is safer than movement. Consistency feels comfortable. Volatility is frightening. Therefore, consciously or not, we attempt to protect ourselves against life's volatility by cultivating robustness in our lives and organizations. But as Nassim Taleb's The Black Swan and the financial crisis it predicted have shown us, the most static systems are in fact the most fragile. But where does this volatility come from, and how do we adapt to it? Because if we're going to lead our lives and our organizations in a way that's actually in agreement with the world, we first have to understand what exactly it is we're agreeing with. In his 1942 book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, the Austrian-American economist Joseph Schumpeter introduced the notion of the innovation economy, in which the market isn't driven solely by efficiency, but by great shifts in supremacy. He characterized capitalism by its violent bursts and catastrophes, a process he colorfully dubbed creative destruction. Schumpeter saw the shifts occurring in the world in his day, the movement away from rigid standardization and toward the fluidity that we now know. He argued that evolving institutions, entrepreneurship, and technological change are at the heart of economic growth. He also said that the incentive to innovate is what makes capitalism the best economic system.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?